Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
This is Kevin O'Brien of EWTN's Theater of the Word. I'm excited also to teach middle school and high school literature, speech, and drama with homeschoolconnections.com, an online Catholic curriculum provider. Your student can meet with me online for a live, interactive class. Whether you take apologetics with John Martinoni, or grade school with Jackie De La Viaga, or any of the other 400-plus courses with homeschoolconnections.com, online Catholic learning for your homeschooling family is available for you.
This episode is brought to you by Hallo, the number one Catholic app. Hallo has 1,000 audio-guided prayers and meditations for you to deepen your relationship with God. To listen to all of the Hallo meditations for free for 30 days, head to hallo.com/breadbox.
Hello, and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Excited about today, because we've got two of our favorite apologists from right here in the in our apostolate, Catholic Answers. Second hour, Carla Broussard will be here, and we're going to try to overcome obstacles to faith in Jesus. If you feel that you have an obstacle to committing yourself to Jesus, to coming fully home to Jesus, then the second hour is perfect for you. Maybe you've got someone that you want to help to overcome that obstacle. We welcome you, second hour. First hour, we're going to do tips for defending the faith. If you'd like some tips for defending the faith, whether to an atheist, an agnostic, whether to maybe a person who's of a non-Christian religion, maybe a fellow Christian, you want to defend the Catholic faith to them. Any tips for defending the faith? Any questions about tips for defending the faith are welcome. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. And we've got just one of the best in the world to help you out this hour. It's Trent Horn, the author of Answering Atheism, Persuasive Pro-Life, Why We're Catholic, and a whole bunch of other books. Trent Horn, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Cy. Next hour, when you're with Carlo, can you ask him if he has any recommendations for how I can give not just my whole life over to Jesus, but even like when I drive, like when I'm in my car, like I'm looking for like a prayer or maybe a song, like to really encourage me to like, even like when I'm in my car, I want to give that over to Jesus.
Do you know how life is like a process of ongoing conversion? And then there's new places in your life where the gospel light needs to shine all the time. I actually had a moment in my car one time where I realized, you know, the gospel, it just came to me. Like, the gospel is true when I'm in my car, just like it's true when I'm not in my car. I have to stop driving like this. Are you still?
The idea here is, no matter where you're at, you want Jesus to take the wheel.
Oh, I see.
I gotcha. There you go. Also, for all our viewers on YouTube and Facebook Live, I would like your comments if you are as horrified as I am by the cat picture next to Cy Kellett.
I don't know what you're talking about. 888-318-7884. Trent is also the proprietor of the Council of Trent, a very popular podcast defending, well, all the things you'd like defending, defending Jesus and his church and defending life and engaging in wonderful conversations with people who might agree with Trent and might not agree with Trent. You can find that at TrentHornPodcast.com. That's where you can go. And Trent announced yesterday that he's going to be doing the podcast on YouTube and including PowerPoint videos. And that is when I announced that we are going to include cats in our videos from now on. 888-318-7884, the number, if you have a question about how to defend the faith, some aspect of the faith. There's something about the faith that you would like help defending, maybe to a friend, maybe to a colleague, maybe to a loved one. Maybe to someone who believes, maybe to someone who doesn't believe. Trent Horn is the guy to call. 888-318-7884. It does seem to me tips for defending the faith sometimes has morphed now into we just need to defend basic reality. And I'm going to tell you why. This is a rumor I heard today. I heard that this is in the news, but I don't know that there's a proposal for legislation here in California. You know the beloved state of California.
My ex. Don't get me started on my ex.
California is your ex. Stores will be fined for having sections of the store labeled boys or girls.
Well, I'm just glad they didn't tell the stores that they have to have 52 different sections to correspond with the 52 genders that exist.
But don't you get the feeling like we just have to defend reality sometimes? Like it's not all high apologetic. Sometimes you just got to go, nah, it's okay to have a boys section and a girls section.
Right, but there is, and this is something I briefly mentioned yesterday, Si, when I said that Ryan Anderson's excellent book, When Harry Became Sally, it's a cheeky title, but I think it's an appropriate one. And it's a very well-researched and compassionate book addressing transgender ideology, and Amazon pulled it. It's as far as I know, it is still not available on Amazon anymore. It might be at Barnes & Noble, I don't know. But it's just about crushing opposition when you put forward such a distorted view of reality. And also, it's internally contradictory, Si, because on the one hand, people will say, oh, well, gender is, it's just a social construct, you know, whatever. Right. They'll say that, but then I want to ask them, okay, but transgender seems to be a very real thing that people hold on to, that men and women, they'll say, if you can be a man or you can be a woman, it's based on what you experience. Okay, but it seems like you see there's a difference between being a man and a woman beyond our experiences. Because if I were to say a transgender man was actually a biological woman who is claiming to be a man, that would be considered hateful. So clearly, people distinguish man and woman are different. They are not the same. Even transgender advocates agree men and women are not the same. So my question for them, and it's the question no advocate has ever or will ever be able to answer, is what is the difference between men and women?
Right.
What is it that makes men men and women women? Beyond, and the only definition they can give is, well, a man is someone who says they're a man and a woman is someone who says they're a woman, which evacuates the terms of any meaning whatsoever. So, it's difficult to see that, but we have to be able to put forward in charity. We have to be able to respond to these claims.
888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I'm going to go to calls right now, Trent, a bunch of folks on the line. It's Tips for Defending the Faith this hour with Trent Horn. If you'd like tips on defending some aspect of the faith, you are welcome to call. I think there's two lines open now, 888-318-7884. But I have to tell you, I don't usually read you comments from Facebook, Trent. But Patrick, our good friend Patrick in New York, says that somebody did a great job on the lighting for Trent's studio, that the lighting has improved in Trent's studio. I just thought I'd
tell
you.
You know what? Well, that's good to hear. Honestly, it's not the lighting. It's the it's a camera. I bought a brand new camera, and slowly but surely, I'm trying to get my studio up and rolling here. I had an old Logitech webcam, and then I bought a new one. And you always think the new one will look a lot different and sleeker than the old one, but it almost looked the same. And I'm like, I got gypped. It looks the same. Then I plugged it in. I'm like, oh, it's actually very different. So,
well, I thought you would like that because you were just asking us just before we went on the air, does this look better? And then right out of the box,
somebody noticed.
Patrick in New York said it looks better. So, all right, off to the phones we go. Oh, we're starting in Germany. We are starting in Germany with Jason.
In Deutschland.
Watching it on YouTube. I'm glad they have YouTube. That I think that I'm not sure. Do they still have it in Australia? Australia's been having trouble. But Jason in Germany, you there with us?
I'm here.
Hi, Jason. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hello, Trent. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Thanks for taking my question.
Thank you.
I've heard it said, usually from Orthodox, that because Peter also ordained bishops in Antioch and I believe Alexandria, that therefore this unique office of the papacy is it's multiple. So how do we defend the claim that it's only the final resting place of Peter in Rome where this unique role comes from?
Right. And so what I would say is that how we engage those who say that, well, all of the bishops. Now, what's interesting here is I think the Orthodox would hold that it's not just in Antioch or other places where Peter was. They would say that all of the bishops are equal, but that it's interesting, though, the Orthodox say that the Bishop of Rome has a primacy of honor, but not a primacy of authority. They will say the Bishop of Rome is the first among equals. So it's interesting, Jason, this argument that you have heard that, well, Peter ordained bishops. He probably ordained bishops at Antioch. He was, you know, he was the bishop of Antioch before he was in Rome. So therefore, all of the successors of these other sees where Peter was would have equal authority with each other. But even the Orthodox don't believe this because they say that Rome is first among equals, or it has a primacy of honor. But they're not willing to grant that as a kind of primacy of authority. So even they admit, compared to the other sees, Rome, there's something special about the Bishop of Rome, but it's only a primacy of honor, not one of authority. So I think there are two ways we should go about, I think, when Catholics and Orthodox dialogue about this issue. One, I do believe that Catholics should ask Eastern Orthodox to bear a burden of proof in this regard and put forward evidence saying, okay, well, you're claiming there all the bishops have equal authority. There is no bishop that has authority over other bishops or serves to settle disputes between them. Where does the Bible or church history affirm this kind of leadership? So I would ask them to prove that instead of just starting it as an assumption that the Catholic has to disprove. I'd ask them to prove it. And then number two, I would go to both the New Testament to talk about Peter's unique role. But you might say, yeah, but what about Rome? What about, you know, Peter's unique, but how does this factor into Rome? I would just say, how is the Bishop of Rome viewed in the early church? And it's very clear that the Bishop of Rome is necessary to ratify ecumenical councils. In the second century, Pope Victor I excommunicated an entire group of churches for not celebrating Easter on the wrong date. St. Irenaeus said it wasn't a great idea to do that, but never said he didn't have the authority to do that. So it seems clear in the early church that there is an appellative function to the Bishop of Rome. You appeal to him. And so I know some Orthodox apologists who say, yeah, he has universal appellate duties. Like, you can appeal to Rome, but that doesn't mean he has universal jurisdiction. And I said, well, that's kind of a difference without a distinction. So those are the two tacks that I would take. And as a resource, Jason, I would recommend there's a great debate that was just hosted on Matt Frad's Pints with Aquinas YouTube page between Eric Ibarra and an apologist for Eastern Orthodoxy. I would highly recommend that you go and watch that if you haven't already. Eric is one of the best guys out there on engaging Eastern Orthodox brothers and sisters. So is that a helpful reply?
Yes, it is. I watched that debate, and Ibarra and I were friends on Facebook, so I'll bring it to him as well. I'm just trying to get some more clarification on this.
Sure, absolutely. And tell Eric I said hi.
I will. Thank you so much. God bless.
Thank you, Jason.
Perfect.
Trent Horn's our guest this hour, and you can ask anything about if you need a tip for defending the Catholic faith. If there's some aspect of the faith that you would like help defending, Trent is here to help you. 888-318-7884. I'm just going to read it the way Carrie wrote it. We got this ad. Tell me if this makes sense. All right. Apologist Alley Wednesday. Have you visited Apologist Alley? Apologist Alley can be found at shop.catholic.com and has all the resources by your favorite apologists separated by apologists. Want to load up on Trent Horn resources? Visit the Trent Horn section. Love Carlo Broussard? Check out the Carlo Broussard corner of Apologist Alley. And today until midnight, you'll find all of Trent and Carlo's books, CDs, and DVDs on sale at a very special price. That's Apologist Alley at shop.catholic.com.
Call us now with your question. Hello? On Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy Kellett. Catholic Answers Focus is the podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith, and you're not going to want to miss it this week. We've got our friend Monica Dumit from Australia to talk about what's happening with confession and how governments are infringing on the right to confession around the world. And we've also got Chris Check, the first part of a three-part series on the Inquisition. CatholicAnswersFocus.com is where you can find us, or find us wherever you get your podcast, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or just watch us on YouTube, CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious mystic monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All mystic monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase mystic monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Celebrate the beauty and sanctity of humanity with the Gift of Life Novena Bracelet. Designed exclusively for EWTN, it features 9 prayer beads, a St. Benedict crucifix, a miraculous medal, and medal of St. Anne with her daughter, the Blessed Virgin Mary. Ask for the prayers of these holy saints with the Gift of Life Novena Bracelet, now available for just $39.95. To order, go to EWTNRC.com and search for item number 739.
I guess that made sense, Nick. I couldn't figure out what Apologist Alley was at first, but by the time I got to the end of the copy, I understood what it was.
I hope, Cy, so you mentioned that I have a special section of Apologist Alley.
Yeah.
I hope that my section was where a mentor of mine was completely refuted by an anti-Catholic and completely broken, and I saw that, and I was just moved to never let that happen to anyone else again. And so I vowed to fight error. It's Batman. Come on.
Oh, come on.
Batman's origin isn't
an alley. I am so slow today.
Crime Alley. Bruce Wayne became Batman that moment in Crime Alley when his parents were gunned down by.
And you know
depends
what?
On who
I don't know why I'm so slow. Like you're right on the money. But I was stuck because when Nick heard it, he was like, he thought there was like an apologist somewhere named Allison that we were calling Apologist Alley. And maybe there is someone there. Hey, they're talking about me right now.
I might have a talk with marketing on this one, Cy. I think I prefer like Apologist Avenue.
Yeah. Oh, there
like
you
go. An alley, it's like, hey, come back here. I got a tract for you behind this dumpster.
I got a great book on Jesus for you.
I like open up a trench coat and they're all just there. And then someone comes by, those are counterfeit Christ books that he's selling.
That was Trent just went meta on us. He just went right. So meta. Let's go to Newberg, Oregon, before we get ourselves in trouble. You know what? Kerry writes really good copy and we shouldn't be making fun of him here on the air because he writes really good copy. Ryan,
but now people know, go check out Apologist Alley.
Yep. Go check out Apologist Alley where we got a lot of cool stuff. Ryan in Newberg, Oregon, who's listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. You are next, Ryan. Go ahead with your question for Trent Horn.
Hello. Can you guys hear me?
We can, yes.
Yeah, we do.
All righty. My question, Trent, is what tips do you have for dialoguing with someone who self-describes himself as an agnostic materialist?
That's an interesting combination of words, Ryan, because a materialist is someone who believes the only things that exist are those things that are composed of matter. And an agnostic would be someone who is, when it comes to the question, does God exist? Their answer is maybe or I don't know. But if you believe the only things that exist are composed of matter, then you would necessarily be an atheist because God, by definition, is an immaterial being. So I hope this person just might be mistaken with their own terms, but it would be the way you would engage them, I guess, would depend on how much of a materialist they are and how much of an agnostic they are. I mean, you can provide arguments to the existence of God, but if they think the only things that exist are things made of matter, then we've got problems. So I think you have to disabuse them of this claim of materialism, the idea that the only things that exist are those things that are made of matter. So there's a variety of ways you could do that. You could ask them, well, what about things that appear to exist and are real but are not made of matter? So you could say, look, if something's made of matter, it seems like I've got my phone here, okay? And it's made of matter, so that means that we could locate this phone in the universe based on its spatial location. So I can describe this phone through a physical description. I can make a physical material description. If I knew the location of every atom, I could perfectly communicate this phone to you, where it is, if it's material, okay? But there's other things that are out there like minds. Like you're looking at the Catholic Answers Live app. There are people who are looking at their radios. They're having images of looking at material things. You know, we have images in our mind of things. We're all thinking about different things. But our mental states seem very real, like I really am having a mental state. It's not an illusion. I think, therefore, I am. But my now the materialist may say, well, your mental state is just this electrical thing in your brain. No, that can't be the same thing, because if you know every single thing about this electrical state in my brain, you still won't know the mental state I'm having. You won't know what I'm thinking about in my mind. Like, what I'm thinking about, you can't find it with spatial coordinates. So that's one thing I would do to make a challenge to materialism. I would say that if you're a materialist, you can't believe people have moral responsibility, that we can hold people morally accountable because they're just matter in motion. You can no more, if materialism is true and we're just matter in motion, then you can't hold a serial killer morally responsible for killing people any more than you could hold an avalanche responsible for killing people. It's just matter in motion that has bad consequences. So there's a variety of ways you might do that. I'll leave you with an argument here. Well, actually, it's a short essay by Ben Page called Arguing to Theism from Consciousness. You can get it at academia.edu. Ben Page, Arguing to Theism from Consciousness. He teaches at Oxford. And it's an interesting argument for the existence of God from the fact of consciousness and how it can't be explained as a purely material thing. So that might be some of the routes that I would take. Is that helpful?
Yeah, it's really helpful, especially the part with minds, because this person is really into psychology.
Right, yeah. So if you're trying to figure out what it means for that we have mental states that cause things, if the mind is something real, then we, you know, materialism is a very, very hard time explaining that.
Yeah. Thanks. I appreciate the call. Boy, very busy. A lot of people want tips for defending the faith with Trent Horn today. So we'll go to Ogden, Utah, where Bryce is watching on Facebook Live. Bryce, go ahead with your question for Trent Horn.
Hey, Trent. So I need tips on defending the faith in God against atheists who dismiss cosmological arguments because they say, quote, quantum mechanics proves that uncaused causes exist. But if all quantum interactions conserve energy, how are they saying that? I just don't know what to tell them.
Right. And I think that's an important point to address. You'll hear people say this all the time, like, oh, well, you have you've got quantum. There's two ways they go about it. They might say, well, you've got things that appear to not have a cause. The most famous example would be so-called virtual particles that seem to emerge from a quantum vacuum without a cause. But that phrase without a cause is very ambiguous. Or atomic nuclei. So the center part of atoms, when they, so the nucleus of the atom, or the protons and the neutrons are, this particle is emitted when they experience atomic decay. We're not able to predict when that happens. But the way I would argue against this is to say, look, we do see causal elements here, whether it's in, and there is a dispute about whether so-called virtual particles actually exist. Like, scientists don't really agree on what these fundamental particles are. Some of them think they're not even real. They're just kind of mathematical bookkeeping devices to understand the formulas in physics. So a few ways I might go about when someone says that these quantum events show there are no causes. I would propose an alternative explanation. I would say, no, we do see a causal relationship here. The atomic nuclei causes the particle to come into existence. The quantum field causes the virtual particle to come into existence. A quantum field is not nothing. A quantum field is an extremely low-level energy state. And so it's capable of producing something. We would just say if it is uncaused, it's not that it's uncaused, it just doesn't have classical causes. So like if you play billiards, for example, and you knock billiard balls around on a table with a cue ball, like the world's best billiards players, they can get at a pool table and they know each angle they hit the cue ball when the balls go around on the pool table, it's extremely predictable. We know what is going to happen. The balls just don't arrange themselves, and it's all very predictable. It involves classical mechanics, classical physics. With quantum physics, you have causes happening, but it's more probabilistic. So we know, like, when I strike the cue ball, 100% of the time it will hit the next ball, and then it will do such and such. But when you get down to these really, really tiny particles, sometimes we have to say, well, there is a causal relationship, but it's probabilistic. 50% of the time, it will decay this way, or 50% of the time, a particle will arrange this way. But it's not something from nothing. Here's a good quote from a physicist named David Albert, a very well-known theoretical physicist. He says that vacuum states, no less than giraffes or refrigerators or solar systems, are particular arrangements of elementary physical stuff. The fact that particles can pop in and out of over time as those fields rearrange themselves is not a whit more mysterious than the fact that fists, like you put a fist, your hand is a fist, can pop in and out of existence over time as my fingers rearrange themselves. And none of these poppings remotely is in the neighborhood of creation from nothing. So that's what I would say is you have probabilistic causes here. And then number two, I would say that they are causal. There is a causal framework here. It's not uncaused because scientists can reproduce these causal experiments. Scientists can reproduce quantum mechanical events in laboratories. There's a famous one you can look up online called the double slit experiment. It involves events at the quantum level, but you can reproduce the quantum slit experiment. The double slit experiment. It's called the double slit experiment. Look it up online. It's a cool experiment, but scientists can reproduce it. If quantum events were uncaused, you couldn't reproduce these events with regularity in laboratories, but you can reproduce them. So there is a causal framework here, even if we don't always know what the cause and effect will be, because it's more probabilistic. So I hope that was a helpful explanation for you. I go into this in more in depth in my book, Answering Atheism, which I would commend to you and other listeners if you want to go and check that out.
Thanks, Bryce. You probably hear the music. That means we got to take a quick break, but we'll come back with more tips for defending the faith with Trent Horn, who's been doing a lot of work for us this week. It's really nice to have Trent back. 888-318-7884.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
If you spend any time on Twitter, Facebook, or mainstream media, you're probably familiar with the litany of slogans that skeptics employ to rescue you from the foolish belief that God exists. The constant onslaught seems to leave people with the idea that they have no alternative but to embrace atheism. How can a Christian respond? In One Less God Than You, John DeRosa breaks down 20 of the most common atheist challenges and shows you how to craft effective answers. Atheism is more aggressive and widespread than ever. Read One Less God Than You and prepare yourself to respond with the joyful truth that God is real. To get your copy of One Less God Than You, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn, our guest this hour. Next hour, it'll be Carlo Broussard. Carlo's going to be here. We're going to talk about overcoming obstacles to Jesus. If you're having trouble yourself coming to faith in Jesus, or if you know someone who is and you'd like to help them overcome the obstacles, second hour is for you. This hour, tips on any aspect of defending the faith. If you would like to defend the faith better, if you would like to know how to defend the faith against a particular attack, you are welcome to call Trent, 888-318-7884. Of course, when I mean Trent, When I say Trent, I mean Trent Horn, who's an extraordinary apologist and speaker and author and the proprietor of the Council of Trent, his podcast that you can find at TrentHornPodcast.com. Let's go to Maryland now. Josh in Maryland is watching on YouTube. Josh, thanks very, very much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Trent Horn.
Hi, I have a question about some of the more Thomistic cosmological arguments. One of the premises is that we need a first cause because we can't have an infinite chain of causes. My question is, how do we defend the claim that we can't have an infinite chain of causes?
Right. So what I would say here, Josh, it's important for people to understand the causal chain we're talking about with the arguments of St. Thomas Aquinas are different than other cosmological arguments. So you have, for example, the Protestant philosopher William Lane Craig. He puts forward the Kalam cosmological argument, which says that the series of past events cannot be infinite. And so it must be finite. Thomas, however, did not believe that the universe had to be finite. He believed the universe could have still been eternal, but even in an eternal universe, you couldn't have an infinite series of causes. There still had to be an ultimate mover. So you might say, well, wait, that sounds like they're both talking about infinite pasts or infinite causes. What's the difference? In the Kalam version, or the version that says the universe had a beginning, you're dealing more with a causal series like dominoes. I used to have these really cool dominoes as a kid that were on these plastic tracks. And so you could assemble the plastic tracks and they had loops. And if anyone's listening, write in the comments on social media if you had these same dominoes as a kid. I love them. But the thing is, with a chain of dominoes, if you knock them over, if you get rid of the first domino in the series, it doesn't affect the rest of the series. You don't need the dominoes at the beginning of the series for the other ones later to fall over. And so that would be the series like all of the days in the past. The past days don't exist anymore. We don't need them to exist for the present to happen. But Thomas is talking about a different kind of causal series. It's not like a bunch of dominoes knocking each other down where you could throw away the old dominoes and it doesn't affect the others falling. It's more like a series of gears. So think of a bunch of interlocking gears that are spinning with each other. These are different. If you take away any single gear in the series, the whole series stops spinning. And so Thomas says that the first cause for Thomas is not like the first domino that knocks over all the dominoes. That's not the first cause for Thomas. For Thomas, it's more like a center rotating gear. It's like one gear in the center, and then all the other gears spin out and away from it. But that gear doesn't get spun by anything else. So that's the kind of series that he's talking about, this continual, or to use jargon alert, an essentially ordered causal series. So to show you, someone might say, well, maybe we don't need that center gear. Maybe if you had an infinite number of gears, they would keep spinning. No, that doesn't seem right. And I think the best way to show that is to just offer thought experiments for people to consider to see if their conclusion is reasonable. One that I like when it comes to showing this, there's two that I like actually to bring it down to earth. One would be a chandelier and the other would be a train. So imagine I had a chandelier hanging above me and it's connected by a series of chains. You know, you have no single chain can hold the chandelier up on its own. It has to be connected to something. And you couldn't explain the chandelier hanging above me if it's just an infinite number of chains going up, because no chain can pull the chandelier up. You put them all together, they don't have any pulling power. They got to be connected to something that's not like them. So that would show you, just as an infinite number of chains can't hold up a chandelier without a ceiling anchor, you can't have these infinite, essentially ordered causes. Another example might be a train. And once again, I'm just thinking of examples from my childhood. I love trains. When I was a kid in San Diego, I would always go to the Model Train Museum in San Diego. It's one of my favorites. Now think of a train car. Can it move on its own? No. If it's a flat grade, it's not going to move. What if you attached another car to it? Well, it's still not going to go anywhere. What if you attached another car to it? It's still not going to go anywhere. No matter how many train cars, like box cars, you attach to it, it's not moving. This would be when we're talking about Thomas's argument for motion, by the way. But if you need, then, even if you have an infinite number of cars, you would still need the locomotive to pull it. You need something different than the cars themselves. So those are two examples that I might give. The train is very analogous to what Thomas argues for the argument from motion and change for the existence of God. The gear example would probably fit better in Thomas's second way. I'd recommend that. And for other resources on these arguments, Ed Fazer has a great book called Five Proofs for the Existence of God. And he also has a good book, Aquinas, that talks about the five ways. And also, you can check out, we have some resources. I think Carlo's written on some of this stuff at Catholic.com. So you might benefit from that as well. Is that helpful, Josh?
Yeah. So basically what you're saying is that we need the source of the causal power.
Right. Just because you add something, it doesn't follow that you're going to establish causal power just because you add things together. And so it's like, let's say I was trying to buy something at a store, okay, and I have Monopoly money. That's all I have is Monopoly money. And I put down $500 Monopoly bill. And the guy is like, you can't buy anything with that. It has no buying power. Okay, but what if I had an infinite number of Monopoly bills? You still can't buy anything, because even if you make an infinite number of them, that doesn't increase the zero amount of buying power each bill has. And I think it's the same for causes. If a cause does not have intrinsic causal power of its own, but gets it from something else, adding them together, even an infinite number of them, doesn't create any causal power. You need it to come from a prime mover or an uncaused cause. So I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thanks, Josh. We'll go now to Bryce in Bend, Oregon, watching on YouTube. Bryce, go ahead with your question for Trent Horn.
Hey, Trent. I'm a fan of the Council of Trent podcast, and I watched the episode when you were speaking from the man from street epistemology. And I
yes.
watched a talk he did where basically he said when he wanted to talk with Christians on the street, he wouldn't go after their assertions, and he even wouldn't really go after their evidence. He would kind of try to attack the methodology that they would use to come to conclusions. And I feel like
right.
that's really helpful in religious debates to establish a methodology, because like, it's almost like a person should ask when they kind of go down an investigation into religion of saying, well,
right.
what percentage chance should I believe this to be before I accept it? You know, you could think, well, 50-50 would make sense, but then you might consider Pascal's wager and say, oh, it should
right.
probably be lesser than that. And I feel like, I think you've made this observation too, that I found really strong when you were talking about the deuterocanonical books, where,
right.
you know, if Protestants were more aware of this, they would be upset where atheists act as if, oh, I need you to completely prove to me that Christianity exists while I stay with this null hypothesis, this assumption that atheism is true. But then they'll do this similar thing where once they agree Christianity is true, they'll assume evangelical Protestantism is the truth.
Right.
And
yes.
Catholicism
yes.
needs to prove itself. So do you think in conversations I should bring up methodology more when I talk to people? And
oh, sorry, I thought you were done. But go ahead. You got the question, Trent.
Yes, sure. Well, Bryce, thank you for watching the podcast. And yeah, that was a good discussion I had with Anthony Magnabosco. He engages in street epistemology, which if you watch him, you'll see he's sort of an atheistic doppelganger to me. You'll notice when I engage people on the show who are not Catholic, I want to dialogue with them, I'm very Socratic. I want to find out what they believe and why they believe it. And I think it's important for any of us. In fact, this will probably be a future book project of mine. I truly believe we have to learn not just the right answers, but the right questions, the right way of sharing the answers. And we got to get people to question what they already believe before they're willing to accept what we believe. So I believe, Bryce, that you're correct. We need to look at methodology. I would just take the word methodology out, because the average listener might say, well, what do you mean methodology? What's that about? What I mean is you need to focus on asking the other person, what do you believe? And then why do you believe that? Or how do you know that it's true? I appreciate you brought up that this came up in my debate with Steve Christie on the deuterocanonical books of Scripture, that this this happens, there's a double standard with Protestants on the inerrancy of Scripture. So what's interesting is Protestants, when they'll talk to an atheist will say, until you prove the Bible doesn't have any errors in it, I'm not going to believe. And a Protestant will say, well, I don't have to do that. If I know the Bible is the Word of God, even if it has tough passages, I don't have to prove every single one with a solution. There's some tough passages in the Bible. But I can know the Bible's the Word of God, even if there are these apparent difficulties. But then the Protestant will turn right around on the Catholic and say, until you can prove the deuterocanonical books are completely without error, I will not believe they are the inspired Word of God. So they'll borrow the same thing. So you're right, Bryce. It's about going after the core assumptions a person makes and getting them to defend their worldview. This is something I've been preaching, ironically enough, for a while. When we engage Protestants, we have to get them to say, look, how do you shouldn't start with Protestantism as a default assumption any more than an atheist should start with the non-existence of God as an assumption. You have to start and say, hey, where's your burden of proof for sola scriptura, for the New Testament canon, and go from there. But ultimately, what we have to do in our apologetic conversations is ask, what do you think? And then, why do you think that? How do you know that's true? How did you come to believe that? And get the other person to defend it. And hopefully while they're defending it, they will see, wait a minute, I might not have great reasons to believe this, actually. And when that happens, they might be more open to hearing what we have to say. So is that a helpful reply? Or did we lose him?
Bryce?
Oh, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Yes. Is that helpful?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I was saying great response. Big fan. Thank you, Trent.
Oh, well, we didn't want to miss that. I'm glad we didn't miss that. Thanks, Bryce. We got to take a quick break. Right back with more Tips for Defending the Faith with Trent Horn.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
Fallen away Catholic years and years ago, doing my own thing, and my mom and dad never gave up on me, and I know it was the Holy Rosary. And they kept after me, Philip, pray your rosary, and eventually I did. I'm a member of the Knights of the Immaculata, Maximilian Kolbe's group. I'm with the Legion of Mary, and I haven't stopped leading the rosary in nursing homes, thanks be to God.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Tips for Defending the Faith this hour with Trent Horn, our guest. Trent's podcast, Council of Trent, is on the internet, and you can find it at TrentHornPodcast.com. You want to tell us anything about what's coming up on TrentHornPodcast.com? Is there anything good? You doing any? Are there any game show episodes coming up?
I haven't done a game show episode yet. I'll leave that to Catholic Answers Live.
Well, as a matter of fact, Friday we have one coming up with Carlo Broussard, second hour. But you go ahead. What's going to be on your podcast?
Catholic Answers Live focuses on game shows and cat pictures. We have an episode on defending the nature of God that is up. On Thursday, we'll have an episode on how to confront the issue of infertility and treatments of infertility. What are morally acceptable? What are morally unacceptable? Friday, we'll have a free-for-all Friday. You'll find out what that topic will be when it comes up. But I think last week we had weird cases of mass hysteria. So those are always fun, eclectic episodes. And then the week after, I'm going to start debuting Council of Trent podcast episodes on YouTube as well. So those should be a lot of fun.
I'm just going to go right. I'm going to take the bait on where it felt like you were just a little bit dismissive of what we do here on Catholic Answers Live. But I'm just going to move right past that. Moving right on.
Oh, no. I think the game shows are well worthwhile. They definitely teach people about the faith.
Especially when Carlo's here.
Nick in Montana.
Wait, I have one last suggestion for the game shows, though. Can you include slime? Like, if someone gets something right, Nickelodeon slime comes down on Carlo.
Oh, now come on now. Carlo already has to do Pig Latin at least twice in every episode of the game show. I don't think we're... Although his
or
kid,
there is...
His kids might enjoy watching him get slime.
You could do challenge, double challenge, physical trial. What, remember Double Dare?
No, I don't remember that.
Double? You never saw Double Dare?
No.
You probably never saw Legends of the Hidden Temple either.
You know what would be a really fast segment we could do? It would be over very quickly. I could arm wrestle Carlo. We'll just do that. We'll throw that in every time. That... Take about a second.
I think if you looked at Carlo's biceps, you would just already automatically lose.
My arm already hurts. Like, my arm already hurts. Just looking at Carlo's arm. Yeah, I'm like, nah, that hurts, right, man? Nick in Montana's next, and he's waiting patiently. Thomas, you're doing a great job on the phones today, but this is what I have. Nick in Montana, St. Michael. Is that St. Michael radio? Is that a St. Michael pair? Is it literally St. Michael calling? Well, this should be an interesting call. Let's see if this is St. Michael. Nick, you there with St. Michael?
I am. No, St. Well, he's always kind of watching over
good
me.
Good for you.
No, it's just St. Michael radio.
Okay, yeah. Good. All right, good.
Here in Great Falls, Montana.
Oh, that's great. Very good. All right, go ahead with your question for Trent.
All right, so my question is, I'm presenting to a group of catechists in my parish, and we're talking about justification and justification by faith alone and justification by faith faith and good works. And kind of my premise is that, yes, both and. We are justified first by our faith and followed up by a justification by our works after we have accepted the gospel of Jesus Christ. Through love, and that charity is what really kind of pushes us over the edge. Am I on track here, or do I need to be a little bit more specific and give a little bit more detail?
You're on track with it. I think the important points to underscore is that we can say justified by faith alone if it's a particular kind of faith, like when St. Paul in Galatians chapter 5 says we practice faith working through love. A faith that's not merely intellectual assent, but one that that believes and obeys. It's important. The Catechism says in paragraph 2010, I believe, that the first initiative in the order of grace, no one can merit it. So the beginning of our salvation, we could say, yes, we are saved by faith alone, grace alone, the beginning of our salvation. And the best example of that is an infant. When an infant is baptized, they have done absolutely nothing to merit the gift of justification, and justification being that which makes us righteous in the eyes of God. I also think that using particular kinds of imagery to help people understand this, that Protestants view justification more as a legal concept that is declared guilty, not guilty, nothing changes about us. Catholics would say that justification is a familial adoption and restoration where we become adopted sons and daughters of God, and then we partake in God's very nature, as 2 Peter 1:4 says. And so we are changed in becoming children of God and receive the light of Christ, receive that justification, received by grace alone, faith alone. But then in obedience to God, when we do good works and please him, we can increase that light that we have received, even though we can't ignite the light on our own at the beginning. And that what we do, and that really the works we do to be justified, there's only one work we must do to remain in a saved state or to be justified, and that's to avoid mortal sin. So that's a hodgepodge there. Nick, I will give you a cheat sheet, if you will, or a leg up on your presentation. Give your email to our call screener, and then I will email you a talk I just gave at the Fullness of Truth conference. And I gave this talk, and I've uploaded it to my podcast, The Council of Trent. And the talk is on the Catholic view of justification. So feel free to crib from that talk, whatever you like. I will send it to you, listen to it. And then we'll also get you Jimmy Akin's book, The Drama of Salvation. But if you need something quick right now, after the show, I'll email you my talk. Take from that whatever you like. You're lucky, Ed. We just put it up last week on the podcast. And if any of you are listening, you can go to the Council of Trent podcast and just scroll back a few episodes and find it. So what do you think of that, Nick?
Oh, that's excellent. I love the imagery of we can make our light shine brighter, but we cannot start the light ourselves. That's excellent. I think I'm going to probably lead off with that. So thank you very much. I really appreciate your help.
No problem. Remember, because Jesus is the one who said, let your light shine before men, not to put it under a bushel basket. And we can do that by obeying God and growing in justification. That's what James is talking about when he says a man is justified by works and not by faith alone.
Nick, thank you very much for that call, and thank you for listening on St. Michael Radio 97.1 in beautiful Great Falls, Montana. Up next, we go to, well, let me see who we're going to next. Up next, we go to, I'm having trouble with my computer, Daniel in Clarksville, Tennessee, watching on YouTube. Glad to have you, Daniel. Go ahead with your question for our guest, Trent Horn.
Hi, Trent. I sent you an email earlier. You never replied to it, so I guess calling in is the best way to get a hold of you. Basically,
did you send it through my website?
Being good. I think it was through your website. Yeah.
Oh, sometimes they get lost in my spam folder. I do apologize for that. We've had problems with that, but now you're here. Go right ahead.
Yeah. No worries. Anyways, it has to do with existence being goodness itself.
Sure.
How does that relate to, say, the existence of a torture device?
Mm-hmm. Right. So the claim existence is goodness itself. Well, what I would say is that to exist is a good thing. Existence is a good, but it doesn't follow that everything that exists is used for good. So I guess, I'll pause in a second to make sure we're tracking. The classical understanding of good and evil is that goodness is a thing. It is equivalent to being, and evil is an absence of being. It's an absence of goodness. It's a lack of being. So being and goodness are kind of interchangeable. So we would say evil is not a thing God made. It is an absence of good found in a thing that God made. And your concern is, well, how could that be the case if there are things like torture devices that seem to exist and are designed to cause pain and evil? Before I give an answer to that, did I summarize your position correctly?
Yes, that's pretty much the gist of it.
Okay, good. And what I would say is that a torture device, the evil that is inherent in a torture device comes from the intent of the user, not so much in the thing itself. Like when I go to the dentist and I sit down in the dentist chair, and most of us going to the dentist have had this feeling, and you sit down there and the light's shining on you and you got the little the paper bib on, and you look over and he opens the tray and all the devices come out. My heart starts beating really fast. It looks like a torture tray. You've got the metal jagged knife things all right there. And honestly, if you were in the hands of an evil dentist, which has shown up in horror films more than once, that would be torture devices. But a good dentist would use those things to actually do good and get rid of plaque and other nasty things in your gums. So if you think about torture devices that human beings have created, they're usually combinations of things that are good in and of themselves, like metal, spikes, wood, rope, things that are good and can be used for good purposes, but are either used for evil purposes or arranged into some kind of device for an evil purpose. But the things themselves are morally neutral. They have being, they exist, they're good in that respect. So I guess that's how I would answer the question. Is that helpful?
So just to make sure I'm getting this correctly, items themselves don't necessarily have any intentionality built into them when you make them. Like, for instance, a table is used to store things on top of.
Right, yeah. Right. Now, some things that are created may be evil, but it's because they still lack some kind of a goodness. So some kind of pornographic visual medium, pornographic piece of art or something like that, or film. I would say that is an evil thing, but the things that it is composed of, like cellular film or pencils or pixels, those things are matter. Matter is good. God made matter. That's the Manichaean heresy in the early church that said the material world was made by an evil God and we should worship the spiritual God that made the spiritual world. The matter itself is I would say it's good that it exists, but it's morally neutral. It's not a morally good thing. It's just a good. Existence is better than non-existence. If human beings reassemble matter into devices to use for evil purposes, that reflects evil in their hearts, for example, not an evil in something that God created. So I hope that that is helpful, and I'm glad you called.
Thank you, as a matter of fact, very much for the call, Daniel. A second hour, Carlo's going to be here, and we're going to do overcoming obstacles to Jesus. If you have one in your own life, or if you know someone who does and you'd like to help them, the next hour is completely for you. 888-318-7884 is our number. Trent Horn has been our guest this hour and on a bunch of hours this week. Trent, thanks for all the work you've done for us this week. It really is really nice to have you back with us.
Yes, it is nice, and looking forward to being a part of more shows, so good to be here.
A lot of great stuff happening over at the Council of Trent, Trent's podcast. You can find it by going to TrentHornPodcast.com, and if you want to get Trent's books on sale, like we said earlier, they're over at Apologist Alley over at shop.catholic.com, which I have not checked out yet. I've got to go check out Apologist Alley, but find all of Trent's books, DVDs, CDs on sale at shop.catholic.com. Hang on, we're coming right back. Carlo Broussard, overcoming obstacles to Jesus.
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.